Alright, so we're actually ready for you now.
Okay. So, just to start, we're going to discuss some work we've been doing, working with Mr. LaRouche, part of this basement research team, a scientific research team, working with Mr. LaRouche. Covering areas of economics, fundamental science, and recently been doing a lot of work on studying the actual evolutionary history of life and drawing out what universal principles that actually expresses, what that actually tells us about the nature of the universe fundamentally and what we really need to draw from that politically right now at this current time of crisis. And to start it off, to take away LaRouche has been recently discussing some of these issues, he wrote a paper in November of last year that I liked a lot, where he played with the notion of the term elementarity, the elementary, what are the elementary components of the universe? And if you go to any standard education, in most regions of the world at this point, people are being brainwashed with a literally bottom-up mechanistic conception of what's elementary, what's fundamental about the nature of the universe. You're taught that what is true, what's real is fundamental particles, fundamental little hard balls of matter, little building blocks, and they come together and they build bigger structures, molecular structures, atomic structures. They come together. Eventually, you can get light. Eventually, you get the solar system, the Earth, galaxies. But you have this conception that that what's true in all that process, the fundamental truth, is just the nature, somehow the nature of these fundamental building blocks, these fundamental hard balls of matter, that somehow the properties of these discrete elements end up determining everything we know about the universe. And everything that we know in terms of the structure of our solar system, the galaxy in which we live in, everything down to light, and even human beings, this doctrine says that all you are as a human being is just an epiphenomenon, a phenomenon that just comes out of the interaction, somehow out of the interaction of these discrete elemental parts, these discrete particles. And that's really what's primary in the universe. And then somehow in any type of science, then all you're really doing is studying the interactions of these fundamental elements through what is otherwise empty space and across absolute time. So just kind of put that on the table as a doctrine that most people are familiar with, even if they're not trained in science, even if they're not pursuing a scientific career. That doctrine about the way the universe works has been culturally ingrained throughout the world, throughout society. And so what we're going to discuss here is one that's completely false. It's a completely fictional conception about the way the universe works. And what we're looking at here, what our studies in the basement have been increasingly focusing on, working with Mr. LaRouche, is reviving a truthful conception about the structuring, the nature of the universe as a whole, with explicit recognition of what mankind's role is in that universe. What is mankind's actual position in the universe as a function of a real science? What does actual, real, competent science actually tell us about these questions? And obviously, as it's been, I'm sure, discussed throughout the day today and previous discussions, I'm sure all of you have been involved in, these are not just idle philosophical questions to go discuss in our armchairs at home and then not worry about when it comes to dealing with real world problems. That the real world problems we're facing right now, the threat of the total extinction, potential extinction of the human species, which the threat of thermonuclear conflict is nothing less than that. But what we're doing as a movement, what we have to do to actually lift humanity out of this crisis, we actually have to understand from the highest level what the crisis actually is. And it comes to this issue of a crisis of an actual, a crisis in the self-conception of human humanity's own failure of understanding itself, what it actually is as a species, as a part of this universe. And to start, I reference this writing, which is, I think it's called Obama's Armageddon Endgame, was the title of this paper he wrote in November 2011, a few months ago. And in it, he sets the whole theme of the paper, discussing the threat of the war, the threat Obama represents, and putting in the context of really lifting the mind of the reader to deal with these the largest fundamental questions about what could we actually lose if we actually lost the human species in thermonuclear war? What are you actually what's on the table there that potentially lose in such a crisis? And he begins by reviving the tradition of a competent tradition in science that's been developed most thoroughly throughout various periods in Western European civilization, going back to the time of Plato and the ancient Greeks, Plato, the works of Socrates, huge revival of this conception under the Renaissance, under the leadership of Cusa. Renaissance literally meaning rebirth of a proper conception of the ordering of the universe, and discarding this completely false notion that the universe is organized somehow from the bottom from up, that somehow everything we experience is just an effect of a bottom-up ordering. But instead, as Lelouch discusses in this paper, and as we get into more, the universe exists from the top down. That this idea that you can somehow get from some of the interactions of the parts, you can get larger processes, you can get higher order processes just as a function of the interactions of the parts. This bottom up view is a false conception, it's purely a falsely imposed idea. But if you take the work of LaRouche in the science of physical economics first, where he has rigorously demonstrated proven the existence of a principle that the human species has that no other animal species has. And this is not just a innovation or a different biological feature or some small change. We're not just a little bit smarter. But if you actually take his work in economics and you look at what he proves that the human species actually expresses a fundamental principle of the universe that no form of animal life that we know of expresses. This power of willful creative action. And we'll get into it, that we'll come back to this through a little more of a discussion, but that the human beings express a power that's fundamentally beyond any simple form of animal life. That if you try to compare the two, it's like an infinity. It's infinitely far away. You can't just keep taking the properties of life as life and then improving them and then somehow ultimately getting to human creativity as a function of animal life. That human creativity is itself already expresses a distinct principle in the universe. It actually expresses a fundamental characteristic of the universe as a whole that is part of the nature of the universe as a whole. And so that's one. You also have a similar distinction looking at the difference between life living processes and non-life, non-living processes. This has been investigated by, for example, Vladimir Vernadsky, a Russian, Ukrainian scientist who's done an immense amount of work, but he was a contemporary Einstein, half of the last century. He also studied this question in detail and also developed rigorous proofs showing that to understand life, you have to understand life as existing as a distinct principle of the universe, that life is not just the result of non-living processes interacting in some interesting way, but you have to actually take life as primary and its own existence in the universe. And so here, right here, taking these two principles, you have now a competent basis to begin actually any real science. Any real science starts from here. Starts from the recognition of life, and even higher than life, human creativity, willful human creativity, as being those are what's elementary. Those are what's fundamental properties about the universe. That these actually express the real nature of the universe as we understand it. And science becomes then, science is an investigation of a universe ordered from the top down. And the best understanding that we have of a creative universe, you take the existence of the power of creativity, of mankind's ability to create new states of the universe that can never exist without the intervention of mankind, in a way that no animal species even can. And again, we'll come to a little bit more of a rigorous picture of this in a little bit. But you take that expression, you have mankind expressing what is really the inherent character of the universe as a whole, which is a creative characteristic. That the universe itself is actually governed by a principle of creativity. And it's not in the way this, the term creativity has been banalized just in common usage, but that the very nature of the universe is governed by this creative principle. And the best way that we actually have to understand that, the best access that we have to the real principle that governs the universe of creative action is actually, which would also be the investigations of science. So our best access to science actually becomes the investigation of the human mind itself. Because in the human mind, distinct from just the biology of the brain, the human mind has demonstrated this ability to resonate with this power of local creativity, that what humanity actually expresses is this unique character of local, of creative action that governs the universe as a whole. So this then reorders what's commonly taught as science and inverts the whole thing. That question of science actually becomes a top-down investigation of how does the universe creatively generate itself? And the best access, like I said, we can get to understanding how that process might work is actually examining the character of the human mind as creative, acting as creative thought, expressing local creative thought, creative power. And so as that is kind of like our opening, our theme of the discussion, one thing we've been involved in investigating and elaborating in some good amount of detail over the last year and a half or so, is how this type of distinctly creative process actually expresses itself in the history of life, in the evolutionary history of life, the development of successively more advanced organisms as life evolved on this planet. And we've taken in detail the last half billion years of records, that last 500 million years, fossil records, different evidence of what types of life existed, or the relationships of the life that existed, and illustrating that it was governed by this process, by this uniquely creative process. And again, inverting all what's taught. What's taught is this, again, is this bottom-up conception where you have supposedly evolution is governed by just successive small changes. And so you have some animal makes a small variation, some random mutation in its genes. It has a small structural change. And then if that change is supposedly good, if it's supposedly advantageous to have, then it's more successful in finding mates in the field, in reproducing itself. So whatever small genetic change that it had now is carried on to its young, and then its young then continues to propagate this new change because it's somehow advantageous. It's a very literally bottom-up conception about the way the evolution of life is supposed to occur, a completely false view. Because what you see, in actually looking at the record, without applying any of these reductionist bias in your analysis, that what you actually see in the record is, if we take this on the first slide, first image there.
It's here.
Okay. Here we have, just to explain the image a little bit. So the actual progression of the development of life is not this just successive change in a timeline fashion where you just have successive one after the other small changes somehow culminating in something larger. What you have is something that actually expresses the characteristic of mind, of intention acting. Intention expressing itself, governing the biology, governing the evolution. And so what we have here is just one very clear example of this process with the emergence of feathers in various forms of animal life, dinosaur life. So what this image is here, it's a little bit kind of technical and not, maybe we could probably make it a little bit clearer, but this is out of a study that has been done to look at where you see feathers emerging in the fossil record. And so by the reductionist view, you'd expect one dinosaur to somehow go through some random genetic change, some mutation, maybe get hit with a cosmic ray or something, and then somehow that it started to make a feather, and then for whatever reason the feathers were advantageous even though they couldn't fly yet, and then it spread the feathers to its young, and then they spread it so on down. What you see is that didn't happen. That what you had is actually completely independent types of dinosaurs, completely unrelated types of dinosaurs that didn't have a common, all independently developing, generating things on their own somehow. When you have each of these red blocks here, the whole tree represents the supposed relationship, the tree of life, the structure, the believed relationship between the different types of dinosaurs, what's related to what, which ones have common ancestors. So that's the tree you see there. Everywhere you see those red blocks, the red marks, is a place where one type of dinosaur independently on its own developed feathers somehow. So what you have is that and you see it happen in a whole series of cases at different periods of time by unrelated species. So instead of this bottom-up causality, you actually have the inversion. You have a future state, which is what we now know as birds, as flying animals. You have a future state of the biosphere, a future state of life, attempting to express itself in what is for that future state the past. You have an actual process of the future state attempting to come into existence, acting on and affecting a past state. And so you have this, which is completely characteristic of what we open with, which is a creative process, the action of mind. It's a type of characteristic activity you'd associate with the activity of mind, the action of creative thought, where it is the creative thought that actually determines what the future is going to be. It's not a succession of just pairwise interactions, but it's the intention to generate a future state of existence that then determines the past and determines the changes in the small and in the past. And so you have here, with this example, the dinosaurs developing the feathers is just one example out of an array of examples of this actually being how life actually developed, actually operated. That evolution actually, characteristically across evolutionary history, expresses this time reversal characteristic. Where it continues the future state that doesn't yet exist is acting on it's what's actually acting and changing whatever is the present state at the time or what you can view as the past state. You see this also with mammals. Some of the most fundamental characteristics about mammals didn't emerge just from one species and then somehow get changed, get spread successfully just through generations. But again, they emerged in completely independent, unrelated species. Completely unrelated species develop these same mammalian characteristics on their own as an expression of a future state beginning to try and express itself and governing the developments in the what could be the time, the present, or the past. So this example here, just one example, there's an array of them, but this is the characteristic of time and causality, an indication of the type of causality you actually see expressed in the development of life in the evolutionary process. So we move to the next slide, number two. Yep. Keep that in mind now. So now you have an idea about the way there's a certain, the reductionist view just doesn't work. Creative structure that we've associated with the quality of mind, of creative thought expressed over the evolutionary process. So now let's pull back and look at the large-scale picture and take an example of how this has expressed itself over this whole period of 500 million years. And so what you have here, in this second image, this is what they generally refer to as a biodiversity curve. So on the bottom there is time, about the last 540 million years, and the curve represents running from left to right. So the oldest time period is on the left, the most recent is on the right. What you have here is you're measuring how many different distinct numbers of species do they find in the fossil record at any given period of time. You can see that in the most recent period of time, we have the largest number of different types of species existing on the planet. And if you go back, it's gone through ebbs and flows, some big collapse points, some big points where it expands very quickly. But this is one of the best kind of top-down pictures we have of the development of life over this whole, of animal, of advanced animal life, of this whole half billion year period, this total biodiversity curve. So this is already indicative. It shows you a lot that the whole thing's been expanding. You had the expansion of life, the continuous generation of new, more and more types of species. The biosphere has been getting more complex, more different types of species existing over time. But then it becomes even more interesting if you take certain qualitative characteristics of life and see what the record shows when you look at how these certain qualities, when you examine this as a function of certain specific qualities. And so one, for example, that becomes very indicative of the actual principles governing this entire process is the metabolic rates of different types of animals. You can see that in the next image, in the third image. Ignore the cones on the right for now. A few different curves one successfully above the other. And what these illustrate is, these are examples of different types of life we have today, the different metabolic rates of different types of life. So the top curve is birds. Birds generally have a higher metabolic rate. Below them is mammals, also relatively high metabolic rates. Below them is reptiles, and then amphibians tend to be lowest. And so this, if people aren't familiar, metabolic rates is generally measures how much consumption, how much energy intake does any form of life need to sustain itself. So, for example, mammals will have to consistently eat more, they have to breathe more rapidly, they have to consume more water just to maintain themselves. So if you have like a mouse and a lizard of the same weight, the lizard has to eat less, it doesn't have to breathe as much just to maintain its own biological functions. So so you take this as a characteristic that certain more advanced forms of life, as we'll see, they actually require a higher energy consumption, they actually require higher energy intake to support themselves compared to lower forms of life. So if we take this as a characteristic, take that oxygen rate as a certain characteristic of life. Let's go to the next image. Fourth image. And now if we take our... Now, we're going to look at this over the scale of the whole evolutionary process. So now you take this question of metabolic rates, and you classify animals by whether they have generally lower metabolic rates or generally higher metabolic rates. So ones that are generally less energetic, less energy intensive, and ones that are generally higher, more energetic, more energy intensive. And so if you divide this whole biodiversity record, which we showed previously, by metabolic rates, you then get something that looks like this, where the green part of the curve is organisms with higher metabolic rates. All of the gray part of the curve, the lower part of the curve, are organisms with generally lower metabolic rates. So this is interesting, but it's still limited in what you can see from just this picture here. You can see they kind of fluctuate together. But they both fluctuate a lot. But if we take, for example, you take any point in time in this process. Say you take the 100 million years ago. Say how many types, and you count, but what are the values for these two curves? You say how many species existed with generally higher metabolic rates, how many with lower, and what's the ratio between the two, what's the proportion? So about 100 million years ago, it was about 500 to 500. It was about a 1-to-1 ratio. So if you do that, if you look at the proportion, what's the proportion between the two types of life? What's the percentage? Then you get the next graph, and then it becomes very interesting. Then it becomes really, now we're starting to get at some real principle governing this entire evolutionary process. Now what you see, again, we're dealing with this entire past 500 million years, we're looking at but as a function of the metabolic rates. And so we're looking at how life has, again, the time going from left to right. So left is the oldest periods, right are the most recent periods. And this is now in a percentage or in a ratio. So what you see is that the percentage of animals that exist that have a higher, that are more energy intensive, that require more energetic energy requirements just to maintain their own activity, that is steadily increasing and becoming more and more dominant. So over the evolutionary period, over the evolutionary history, what you see as a characteristic of life is this principle of moving towards what we call high energy flux density. Or maybe more precise, higher biospheric energy flux density. And if you look at that, we're taking all of these different types of animals, and we're looking at the different how the consumption requirements for all, like, form of life now, all forms of life across the whole biosphere, from fish to mammals, other vertebrate life, to beavers, to crabs, to clams, all forms of life throughout history, move toward higher levels of energy consumption, higher level of energy activity of the whole biosphere. This actually has governed the whole history of life as we know it. And again, now we can keep that and bring back on what we discussed in the question of the feathers and how the feathers should emerge different unrelated types of species.
Most have something.
The sound is kind of breaking up, Ben.
Oh yeah.
I don't know.
Just recently, sir.
Just in a few 2 minutes. Last 2 minutes.
Okay. Is it back now? Is it clear now?
Yeah. I think it's when you get too far from the microphone.
Oh, is that it? Okay.
I think so.
Is it quiet?
No.
Oh, I need you, yeah.
Okay, it's about 2 minutes or so.
No, we heard everything.
You don't need to repeat it. It was just a few words.
Okay. Yes. So then take these two principles. So now we're actually beginning to build up a real conception of what is the structure of this process of the evolution of life. You have on the one hand the principle of progress towards higher forms of life, more complex forms of life, which is directly related to the constant increase in the whole energy of the biosphere, the whole energy consumption rate, the whole energy flux density of the biosphere. So that's constantly increasing. And the way that's increasing is it expressing itself through this quality of a time reversal characteristic, where it's the constant desire to create this higher energy state that's determining the changes at any given moment. That it's not just a domino procession of one thing hits the next thing and then somehow you get some changes out of that process. But it's actually the desire, the intention to generate a more complex, higher energy state that's actually governing evolution. That's actually governing the process of change and development. So now we're beginning to get a principle of what is the overall process. What is the overall process of the development of life? And here we can add another consideration that becomes very interesting, which is that any single species that you choose, it participates in this process, but any single species can't create this entire process. It can't act on this entire process. That by the very fundamental nature of life, any particular species, any single species, has what we should call a fixed mode of existence. This is basically what's discussed today in terms of ecology, different ecological relationships. That any species is going to be, it's going to have certain predators. It's going to eat certain food. It's got to have certain relationships to its environment, to the environment around it. But it itself can't act to change those relationships. You know, one species, a species of fish, I was joking with a friend, a species of fish can't decide to invent a reverse scuba suit to breathe water to move on the land. Like that's completely outside of the fish's capability of doing that. And it's an absurd example, but any individual species, as a species, has no ability to make those changes. The types of changes you do get of life actually moving on the land actually occur through, you know, large-scale evolutionary changes, morphological changes. You had to develop lungs, you had to develop legs, you had to develop various other features, stronger skeletal structures that are more appropriate to supporting life outside of water. So you have a any single species is incapable of making these changes, but these changes are being directed by the process as a whole. So you have this kind of funny irony now, where you have the whole biosphere, the whole history of life has a certain principle to it, a certain principle of progress. But any single species itself, just as one species, doesn't really encapsulate the whole process. It'll participate in it, but one species doesn't create the whole change. There's something larger subsuming the whole process. And what you do see is that the process actually, the process is what defines the species. And it is in this interaction of the fixed nature of any single species with the characteristic of progress in the whole biosphere, of moving towards higher levels of energy flux density, that this interaction is actually what defines the mass extinctions. In fact, the biggest mass extinctions that you see that we have recorded in the history of life actually correspond, as you see here, to the biggest upshifts in the complexity and energy levels of life. That these you have with these ratios of the higher to lower metabolic rates of animals, you have three. It's pretty remarkable that the previous curve, which had a lot of fluctuations, it went up and went down. That when you take the ratios, you seem to get three fixed levels. So you had three levels of basically a fixed relationship for the whole biosphere over millions of years. And then you reach a point where the whole system upshifts. The whole system, as you can see here, at about 250 million years ago, in the very middle of the graph here, you have the movement from the plateau on the left to the plateau in the middle on the right middle there. And what demarcates that shift is probably the biggest mass extinction that we know of, that we have on record, which was the referred to as the Permian, Triassic, or End Permian mass extinction. Those are the periods that it lies in between, the Permian and the Triassic periods, about 250 million years ago. And this is something that, under a reductionist ideology, they basically have no way of explaining currently. Like, there's all this debate about, was it an asteroid? No, an asteroid couldn't have done it. We couldn't find the impact location. You know, maybe we found one that wasn't big enough. Oh, was it volcanoes? It must have been volcanoes, but that's not enough. Maybe it was volcanoes and asteroids acting together, and that's still not enough. Maybe it was volcanoes, asteroids, and global warming. There's a whole lot of investment to try and create a kinetic cause. And to not discredit the destructiveness of asteroid impacts and huge volcanic activity, these are very devastating events. It can be dramatic consequences. It can have huge effects, but the point is that the actual principle of the process itself is governed by this characteristic of intention, of progress, a characteristic of mind, of creation. And it's not a kinetic causality. And this comes out, I think, most clearly in these mass extinctions. It's a big irony from the standpoint of any reductionist attempt to discuss this, that the biggest mass extinctions, here you have demarcating the move from the first plateau, the first stage, to the second stage. You have this Permian-Triassic mass extinction. They different estimates show anywhere up to 95, 96, some odd percent of every species that was alive at the time was wiped out, this mass extinction. Probably one of the largest, if not the largest, of this entire period. Following that, you have the motion from the second system to the third system, which is also demarcated by one of the largest mass extinctions, one that most people are generally more familiar with, which was the KT mass extinction, the Cretaceous-Tertiary mass extinction, which was the one that famously eliminated the dinosaurs. And again, there's a lot of discussion about could an asteroid impact have done it, whatever. But the point is, the irony in this whole process, what doesn't fit with any reductionist view, is the fact that the largest extinctions, the supposedly most destructive bad events, actually correspond to the biggest shifts in progress in the history of life. That they actually correspond to the biggest upshifts in the energy flux density, the energy requirements of life. And so what you have here, really, is the expression of, one, the principle of progress. But that's expressing itself against the fixed nature of any particular species. Any species or any set of species has a fixed biological relationship with its environment. It can't willfully act to change with the changing times. As the whole biosphere is advancing, if that particular species cannot advance with it, then it faces extinction. And so here you have the extinctions, which are supposedly chaotic, bad events, actually are shadows, are actually expressions of something that is true, which is this principle of progress, which is governing the entire arc of development. You can see that we had it illustrated in the next image, image six. We've kind of illustrated these three successive systems of life, demarcated by these mass extinction events, as shadows of the overall process of development. So here we have something that basically hasn't existed yet in science, which is a top-down conception of the actual principle governing the entire process of the evolution of life, the history of life of the last half billion years or so. And what we see characteristically is something that is impossible to explain from the standpoint of some type of mechanistic causality, but it's purely expressing something that we best experience in terms of reflection upon our own creative processes. That we see it's expressing itself here with this characteristic of, especially see it clearly with the time reversal characteristic, the clear expression of a future state actually acting on it, generating the changes in the biology, the evolution actually being governed by the existence of a future state which hasn't manifested itself yet. But the intention to manifest that future state is what determines the interactions of all the parts, all the processes on the small. So if you take the whole evolutionary history of life, you have to take the entire process, and then you begin to see this quality of intention of what we might call mind, which the best term might be LaRouche is defined in terms of an actual principle of creativity per se. That creativity per se, creativity as such, expressing itself in the history of life, gives us this expression, this characteristic. We are best familiar with that creative principle because we are the only species that actually, ourselves actually, have that principle in a willful form. That unlike any single species in the entire history of life we've ever known, only the human species actually demonstrated the capability to willfully, consciously act on this entire process. And it literally is that the human mind, the human species actually encapsulates, actually contains the entirety of the process of all evolution of life. The human mind actually expresses the entirety of the evolution of life itself willfully. And so this becomes a new way of getting at an understanding of, so where do we go from here? Where do you draw the implications now that we come to this, begin to develop for people this top-down understanding of science, of the ordering of the universe, where mankind is not just the accidental result of some series of random or chaotic processes. But the mind of man actually most purely expresses the actual substance of the universe itself, which is creativity, which is this principle of creative action. That inherently is what defines the human species and allows the human species to be the only species that we've ever known of any record of at all that could potentially, that could actually potentially continue to exist in this universe, in this process of constant progression and change. That, again, looking at this history, that extinctions are a regular part of the process, because the process is governed by a principle of progress. Human beings are the only species that can actually willfully generate and act on our own principle of progress. That the human species is the only species that can actually willfully act to create our own through economic progress, through technological progress. We can actually act to create our own more advanced state of organization that outpaces the biosphere, that outpaces the development of life generally, and really to subsume it. To subsume it under under the guidance of the willful creative action of mankind. And that's probably most clearly expressed in the challenge in the extraterrestrial imperative, the actual challenge for mankind as a species to begin to populate other planets in the solar system. To actually have mankind actually create the power for existence on Mars as two of the most immediate objectives that could be sought after in the lifetime of young people alive today. Now this actually expresses, I think, in its for people today, in its most purest form, that this mission of an extraterrestrial imperative actually expresses the scientific understanding of what the human species is and has to be if we're going to continue to exist in this universe. And what we're seeing now with the threat, the very real threat of immediate war that could potentially eliminate the human species from this planet, is the expression of an unwillingness to actually act and organize our society in coherence with this scientific principle of mankind as a creative being, as a truly creative species. Mr. LaRouche was discussing, we were discussing it earlier today with some associates, that seeing now is that really fundamentally this threat of extinction, this threat of total warfare between the United States, Britain, and certain France or Western alliances against Russia and China, this completely insane building drumbeat for what would be a thermonuclear exchange. Obviously, completely unnecessary. This is purely expression of...
You're bringing up a bit of again.
Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be that much of your distance, but try to get a bit closer.
Okay. This expresses the it's still the legacy of an oligarchical system, the cultural legacy of oligarchy. That what we're seeing now is the conflict to actually free mankind from a cultural system that denies this creative nature of mankind. You still have the cultural dominance of this oligarchical class-type mentality, where they were a small class, literally views the majority of the human species as just another form of animal, as a form of cattle or sheep. This is explicitly stated. I mean, people like Prince Philip of the British Empire had explicitly talked about culling populations, killing off entire sections of the human population for the means of population control. Literally in the exact same terms as you discuss culling sheep, killing off sheep because you have too many sheep or some other form of animal. But he's not he's just an indicator, a victim of that mentality. He's an expression of what is still a very much the dominant cultural system that still infects mankind, where the idea is we've never actually had a state where we actually had a system where we intentionally promote and facilitate the creative development of every single individual. Every single human soul actually developed to their most full potential this creative power. We've still been living under a system where that happens with certain people. It kind of happens, but the education is often very much corrupted by this reductionist, bottom-up view. So people don't really, they think they're educated, they're taught how to perform certain tasks, but people don't actually think as creative thinkers. They don't actually have a truthful, top-down understanding of what the real role of mankind is in the universe as a creative being. That in looking at our position today, you have to locate it from that standpoint, that we're at the point where humanity has not yet reached that level where we've freed ourselves from this oligarchical system. That the threat of war right now is the expression of this conflict where the outright stated policy of the British is population reduction, massive population reduction, down to the level of 1 billion people. That's the explicit stated policy, that the entire environmentalist doctrine is that policy, that we need to reduce, eliminate 5 billion people from this planet. And as you recall from the climate change summit in Copenhagen, what was it, 2 years ago or so, two and a half years ago, whenever it was, that Russia and China, in leading other nations that agreed with them, but Russia and China most explicitly stood up against this policy and said, no, we will not go with this carbon cap. We will not go with what is ultimately a population reduction policy. That they stood up against this genocidal green doctrine. And I think even that event, I think very much foreshadows what you're seeing now, where Russia, China, other nations, South Korea, India, but in this Asian sector, you're seeing a commitment towards progress. You're seeing a commitment towards nuclear power. You're seeing a commitment towards development of the Arctic regions of the planet, development of new territories, and most purely expressed, this idea of progress, I think, is most purely expressed in the commitment towards space colonization. The only place you have a real, where the United States is eliminating our space program under this insane puppet of Obama, we're eliminating our manned space capabilities. The place you're seeing the biggest progress is China. They just sent up, just recently, another testing out their manned space capabilities. They have serious commitments to progress in this, to go to the moon, to develop colonies on the moon and eventually Mars. That this, where you're seeing the region, the focus of real human progress, is the region that is being targeted by the British. Because they're not coherent with their desire of population reduction, their desire of maintaining the human species at a certain fixed level. But then, this is happening now in the context in which the human science, mankind's science, has advanced to the point where that conflict, that conflict which has existed, it's a subject of any real question of science, any real question of history, of international relations, of statecraft, understand that this has been an inherent conflict, the desire to actually create a republican system of government, the desire to actually free mankind from a feudal type of government, that's been a back and forth struggle. Now we're at the point where that struggle is still expressing itself, but it's expressing itself in the context of a thermonuclear mankind, where mankind has now reached the level of the atom, reach the level of even matter, antimatter, as potentialities. Well, we're actually now tapping into a completely new fundamental power in the universe. That is kind of ironic, because that itself is reflexive of the creative power of mankind, that we can even do that. And that could be the basis for a completely new era of progress and wealth and development and a real renaissance. This nuclear age, thermonuclear moving to matter, antimatter, age. I mean, you eliminate all the problems of poverty, limited resources. These can be completely eliminated under the atomic, the real atomic age, the thermonuclear age. But that can't be done as long as this oligarchical system still exists. And so you right now have a conflict against these two competing tendencies, but it's expressing itself in the context of thermonuclear mankind, which means thermonuclear weapons are the weapons on the table with which this type of battle will be fought today. So what we have to do with the LaRouche movement operating internationally is we have to recruit people to understand this fight at no less of a level than this. That what we're looking at, what we're doing as a movement, what Mr. LaRouche is committed to, what our organization is committed to, is recognizing that this is the substance of the crisis. And what we're fighting for is not just for some small political change, some change in policy or something. We don't just disagree with this or that policy. But what we need to do is actually lift mankind through this new state to actually finally rid human society of the dominance of this oligarchical mentality, this oligarchical cultural system that's persisted for so long. And what that means, what that really means, is a actual spread and recognition of the self-conception of mankind as the only uniquely creative, willfully creative species that has ever existed that we know of. The actual full ridding this whole reductionist doctrine, wiping that off the books, getting this brainwashing out of the schools, and actually developing a new international culture, space-faring culture, recognizing mankind as a uniquely, willfully created, a creator in the universe, a created species in the universe, and that it is our destiny to expand and to develop the universe in ways that would never exist without our intervention. And that having this sublime understanding of what the human species scientifically actually is, what we actually are, what we actually express as a power for the universe, that this actually has to become, that this is politics, this is economics, really. This is what will define the next level of human advance if we're going to create it. And so I would just leave it there for questions and any discussion we want to have, but just to set the tone with that.
Any questions?
Hey Ben.
All right. First, I want to thank you for I think we all know the importance of the Basin team and the work that you're doing, but then also for becoming really good at sort of bringing it out, having discussions and putting it up on LHEC, and I think it's really important. Watched this discussion you had with Asuka just a couple of days ago, and also from the discussion today and what you've been saying, I was sort of wondering why, why do you think these extinction periods are necessary, so to speak? Why is it, why is the universe reacting, saying, okay, these species are not fit? Well, that's probably not the right expression, but, why do you need to get rid of these? Because it seems like if you have an upgrade of the entire system, you would think, okay, so now there's, room enough for everyone, that's the first question. And then also, it's more difficult. I don't know if you can ask how does life know how to be creative, but maybe more I'm trying to figure out how life or how living organisms how is it affected, or how is it, where does the intention come from? Is it sort of inherent? Or is it coming from some sort of other, some impact from somewhere else?
I think for both questions, I think to understand the primacy of creativity as a principle, creativity as the substance of the universe, as what's elemental, is creativity as such. And what you're seeing with life, for example, I mean, the way I would phrase it would be it's creativity expressing itself in the geometry of life to the best it can express itself within the geometry of life. That you have certain inherent characteristics, just the principle of life, by the way, exists for with the question of the fixed nature of any single species, any fixed ecological relationship that's kind of just built in to the biology of life. So there's certain just kind of characteristics that exist just as a function of what it is. So I pose it then, how can a principle of creativity express itself in the domain of life to the best in which it can express itself? And I think in there you define the mass extinction process. I mean, some things don't go extinct. Some things, like, you have certain clams. They've done studies of certain types of clams that live today exactly how they lived 400 million years ago, which is kind of remarkable. It's not doing anything different. It's living the way it lived 400 million years ago. I mean, the species might have changed a little bit, but they're not. They didn't, you know, start doing something completely different. They didn't go move into a totally different region of the ocean or something. Certain of these clam species, for example, and there's plenty of other examples. You know, they're able to maintain themselves in an environment with the biosphere and just continue to do what they're doing, and it wasn't an issue.
So why do they survive, so to speak? Why are they accepted into the new system?
I guess just because they were able to fit in. I mean, there's another case of kind of funny, interesting case. There's a term when clams and worms and different animals actually dig through the sediment on the bottom of the ocean. They have this term they call bioturbation, you know, biology, life, turbation, to churn things up, to mix things up. So this term bioturbation, where you look at how clams and worms and different forms of life will actually churn up and mix up the bottom sediment, the seafloor, the sand and the silt and the dirt from the seafloor. And that process is actually steadily increased over time. That very early on, you know, 500 million years ago, 400 million years ago, the types of life that existed just weren't, they didn't have the energy, they weren't energy dense enough, they didn't have the ability to have their lifestyle where they're constantly digging through the sand, digging through the silt, living underneath it, and then coming back up. You know, it's more of an energy-intensive requirement of life. So you can, people actually done studies mapping the increase in bioturbation, the increase in the amount in which the sediment is mixed up and churned up, correlating that with the overall progression of life. What I was discussing here with the metabolic rates and the energy flux density, that as the whole biosphere became more and more energetic, you got a correlative increase. I mean, if anywhere you look, you get these increases in these certain types of factors. But this one, for example, the bioturbation, you got an increase in the amount in which life would actually churn up the ocean floor. So, whereas you look at rocks that were created from sediment from 400 million years ago, you get a nice, clear layering without any interference. But then rocks that were created more recently, where life was moving in and out of the sediment before the sediment turned into rock, it's all churned up and mixed up. You can see the effects of worms and clams moving through the sediment before it became a rock. But it's kind of a funny note, just to kind of make one small illustration of this. I mean, you had certain types of life that existed by just kind of planting themselves in the sediment. I mean, life, but then they kind of plant it almost like a tree, like a plant or something. They kind of root themselves, sediment, and they just kind of feed by just the different minerals and little bits of bacteria and different things in the ocean that would flow by them. They just kind of live off of that. But then they were kind of planted in like a tree or something in the sediment. You know, they existed for hundreds of millions of years. And then as the bioturbation increased and increased and increased, you eventually got to a point, you know, around 65 million years ago, around that shift, when the bioturbation became so great that these types of animals just couldn't exist anymore. They went extinct.
Sorry, that fell out. Can you repeat that? That?
Yeah. They went extinct. These types of animals that planted themselves in the sediment, they actually weren't able to stay planted because things kept churning up the sediment they were stuck into, and so they would fall over. And so they weren't even able to maintain themselves sitting in the ground anymore because the ground was moving so much because life was moving around so much. I mean, it's kind of a small, you know, maybe a little bit silly example, but I mean, that might be one type of case where you had a type of life that just wasn't really able to progress with the whole system. I mean, the other thing is that you do have, you know, reptiles are still around, amphibians are still around. You know, these were at their times dominant forms of life. You know, reptiles in the forms of the dinosaurs. Now we have them in a different form. They participate in the system, but differently. Some of that, I think, you get into a lot of technicals on that. I mean, I think some of that comes to a question of the actual level of the species as a type of organism. Because it's two very closely related species aren't really that different. I mean, you could have like a blue-tailed, you know, blue-tailed lizard and a red-tailed lizard. Now, they're still lizards. They still can look pretty much exactly the same. The coloration might be a little different in their different species. Species level change doesn't necessarily mean a whole big shift.
Excuse me? You're falling out again.
A species level shift isn't necessarily that big of a level of a shift in the type of life. So if you take, for example, if you go to the question of mammals and reptiles, you know, reptiles as a whole didn't really go extinct. You know, reptiles are still with us. Certain species of reptiles went extinct. Certain dinosaurs went extinct. But the reptile expression of life is still with us. It's kind of in a different form. And personally, I think it's kind of more in that. I think, you know, really, the whole thing really does express much more like a musical composition than anything else. If you go outside of the species and you look at the whole process, you could really track out reptilian life almost like a voice in a musical piece, where it's set very early on. Reptiles have been around for a long time. Amphibians have been around for a long time. But the role they play and the amount of different species they have and the roles of the different species has been evolving and changing, but kind of always staying in a kind of a harmonic tuning with the whole biosphere. So you'll have, you know, fish have been around, sponges have been around, you know, clams have been around, all these different basic types of life. Most of them have been around for a long period of time, but which ones are dominant, which ones are not dominant, which ones have more species of that type and which ones have less species of that type, that seems to be what's shifting and changing. And really, I mean, I think to really understand the whole thing, I think you do have to look at it as if a fugue or a musical composition expressing itself. And I think, so the mass extinctions, and I just wouldn't, it is, I think, from the standpoint of the whole process, it's just inherently much less destructive than the way we've been brainwashed to think about it, because it is an upshift in the whole system. The main types of life still continue through them, but in different forms. You know, it's almost like the whole like the whole system, the internal organization of the biosphere went through an upshift to a new level, which required, you know, morphological changes, environmental changes, changes in the structure of the living organisms. So I think it's more in that range, and I think the key is to not look at the single species itself too much, because the whole thing is that the single species doesn't define its own existence. Its own existence is really only defined in this whole process anyways. That the only species that you actually have that actually expresses creativity, it takes the entire evolutionary process of life, the entire hundreds of millions of years of the evolution of life, for life to actually be able to express a creative principle, what we identify as a creative principle. So the creativity, which is the real substance, that's the real cause of all of this, the creativity only exists in that entire process, and you have different things participating in that. And I just wouldn't, I think the key is, I think we've been so taught to abstract the species as its own thing so much that it kind of mixes that view a little bit. But the only species that actually encapsulates creativity as a species is mankind. The only way that creativity per se can express itself in the universe within a single biology is with the human species. That's the only place where creativity has actually been able to resonate in such a way that it can express itself through the actions of a single species. But to look at anything less, I think you have to look at the whole biosphere, and not with the species. And to touch on the second question, but I mean, I think the point is that again, to start from the standpoint of universe as composed of mind, that what we experience when we're being creative as a creative process is not just some culmination of biological activity or something. It's not just the result of the biology of the brain or the structure of the brain or something like the reductionists that they are trying to make it as. What mankind expresses as what we can generate and resonate with as creativity is a principle of the universe. We're actually expressing the highest principle of the universe. So our best basis for science, our best ability to understand the universe as a whole, is actually continuing and reflecting on the way our own mind works, because that when it's been creatively, because that is the that's the essence of the universe. That's the essence of cause in the universe is mind, is creative action, and so life as a whole is able to resonate with that in a certain way. Is able to resonate and participate in that in its own way. I think you're only going to find the answer from coming from that top-down conception of starting with creativity, substance. That's what's real. And how is that? How do you understand how that expresses itself in these various forms?
Hi. So I was interested in this changes, like you have this change in the dinosaurs where they leap to getting the ability of feathers. And I was interested in, because I've heard something about, you know, the vector of change that is, being, how does this distribute across so many species? And one of the things I heard about was could this be from like viruses or other things? Mm-hmm. You know, like you have this, you get sick, but then you get some kind of genetic change and somehow. So just could you elaborate on this?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm not a full expert on the studies. There have been people that have taken this up as real studies of the viral activity in evolutionary process. I mean, there's a few things I can state. You know, Skye's looked at it a lot more. Jason Roth looked at it more. There's a few basic things that state that definitely indicate that this is a very significant thing. I mean, first is that the human body, we're filled with viruses that are not bad. That the oceans are filled with viruses that are not bad. There's huge amounts of viral activity that is not negative necessarily. That somehow the viral activity seems to be actually an integral part of just the regular operations of the biosphere. So the first step is just to start recognizing, like, well, you might get, for every one virus that makes you sick, we have, you know, I don't have the figures offhand, but hundreds or thousands, maybe even more, distinct viruses that we don't know what they do, that are part of your biology. They're living symbiotically with you, with various forms of life, but we don't know what they do. We're only recently finding out, just beginning to get a sense of how this works with bacteria in the human gut and in different places of other animals, for example, that bacteria actually play a huge role, a huge symbiotic role for life. You actually have a huge amount of bacteria living in your gut that actually not only that play a huge role in helping to break down food and even have certain effects on diseases, obesity, different things are actually now being correlated with different types of gut bacteria that people have. So where you might have one type of bacteria that makes you sick. You have, you know, maybe 1,000, I don't know, a couple hundred, some, for every one that makes you sick, you have a huge number that don't make you sick, that you live with all the time, that actually are probably playing, that are in certain cases definitely playing a necessary functional role. So that virus is similar. I'd say the studies haven't been done as much about figuring exactly what role they might be playing. That's one thing. So definitely, yeah, we want to include that in the whole picture. If you want to look at, get some real resolution in how exactly these evolutionary shifts occurred, that's definitely, certainly something that needs to be put as part of the picture, part of the investigation, to fill it out, to give it more resolution as we move from the top down. And then, you know, the key is going to be, you know, determining the mechanisms from the standpoint of the whole process. Then you can also just ask, well, then where did the virus come from? Or if it's bacterial roles, where did the bacteria come from? The key is always going to be working from this top-down conception of the principle of the progress of the whole of evolution. And then, yeah, we can do a lot more taking the work that's been done and investigating these different potential mechanisms and viral activity one. And I guess the other thing that comes in very clearly, again, I have not done the detail. This through with Skye and others.
You're falling out a bit again, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and again, I haven't done the other aspect to put in. And again, I haven't done the detailed work on it. Others have. I just discussed it through with them. But you have genetic traits, certain structures in your genetic structure, certain components of that, actually, I guess, when they look at them, look like they could have come from viruses or once been viruses or once been part of a virus. And I don't know the details on how they do those studies, but they can look at the structure of DNA that corresponds to certain traits, certain physiological traits. I think one that they found in studying ocean, found in the oceans, is a virus that actually contains the genetic material for photosynthesis. So you can ask, why would a virus contain the genetic material, the genetic program, the genetic capability for photosynthesis? And that's a very provocative question. Yeah, they're these viruses floating around in the oceans right now that have the genetic makeup of photosynthetic capability. I mean, the viruses don't photosynthesize. Viruses don't photosynthesize at all. but somehow they still have the genetic structure that corresponds to the development of photosynthesis as part of them. And there's a whole, there's a big, big, big array of evidence like this that you can look into that definitely points in this direction, this being very likely a significant factor. I mean, the other consideration to include is all of Vernadsky's work on the biosphere and Vladimir Vernadsky. And what he did in actually defining the biosphere as a, I would just leave it at his definition of the biosphere, nothing less than that, where he rigorously proved that you had to look at the thing as a whole system, that all the animals, all the forms of life, plant life, bacteria, everything, and then including everything that they produce by what they interact with, the atmosphere, the oceans, the soils, they're constantly, life is constantly shaping these structures of the earth. The atmosphere is being shaped by life. The atmosphere exists the way it is only because life is acting. If life stopped acting, the oxygen in the atmosphere would be gone in a geological time scale in an instant. It would be gone very rapidly if you look at it on a geological time scale. The only reason oxygen continues to exist in a free form in the atmosphere is because life is constantly exhaling and putting it out there. But this he, I think, gives the framework to then, much of these things, I think he would be completely excited to bring into the discussion and to work into his conception of the biosphere. I think the viral and the bacterial activity is completely part of that, for looking at the not getting isolated on a particular species or particular form of life as self-evident, but seeing it as a part of one coherent process that's tuned to itself to act as a one thing. So I would throw that in also for the context that, you know, look at the viral activity from the standpoint of the biosphere, and then looking at that, how that process then and that process then is being driven towards these future states of the directed states of more complex, higher forms of life. So in taking that top-down view, yeah, there's a lot of very exciting work. Frankly, a lot of it's kind of been done in terms of the details, but then, you know, we have an opportunity to take it and rework it from the standpoint of a real proper top-down conception to understand how it fits in the whole process. And that is definitely one area that's fascinating in that respect. And probably also necessary. One thing that's come up again is the question of actually putting, permanently sustaining human life or any form of biological life off of the earth on another body for a long period of time. Most people don't respect the depth of that question. And that immediately necessitates all of these questions that are right now kind of taken for granted of the electromagnetic effects, bacterial, viral, all these other components that are part of this whole biospheric interaction of life that we're living within, so we don't think about. But then as soon as we're forced to try and sustain life and create a biosphere, create an ability to sustain life on another planet, you're going to be forced to take all these things into consideration and figure them out. And that goes without saying, you're going to make huge revolutions in health science, in fields of healthcare, because you're going to be gaining a completely new understanding of the way biology actually operates and functions. And that will give you huge, huge spin-offs in being able to deal with, you know, every type of health issue that we're plagued with still here on Earth.
Hi, hello.
Speak up.
How do we communicate some of these ideas to the people today, about man's relation to the universe with the present culture.
What?
Oh, you're falling out.
Exactly. Yeah, the immediate answer is to, I think, to express it. Yeah, I think the more we can express it, the more people will recognize it. And the more people recognize it, they'll recognize it as something truthful and they'll respond to it. You know, it's the whole, it is the ultimate challenge. The organizing is the organizing. Developing conceptions in other human minds, you know, that is the ultimate challenge of all this work, because that's how we propagate everything we're doing. It's never going to be a educational curriculum necessarily, but it's going to be, you know, it's always going to come about if you're, you see it when you organize people, when you're meeting people on the street, when you're in a meeting with an elected official or whatever, you can see when you're touching something in them, and you see the response in them, and they often, when you're really moving somebody, they often don't really know why they're being moved. It's not that you satisfied a question, like a logical question they had about fact or something. It's like, well, you know, it's not like they sat down with you already thinking, well, I recognize fixed ecology of any animal species, and I recognize the mass extinctions, but I don't quite get this one fact about mankind or something. It usually you can see when they respond to something that they're not even really sure where it came from, but they know there's something right about it, and that's what they'll resonate with, and that's what they'll respond to. Is getting that sense that there's something outside of what they currently understand that's kind of enticing because it just makes sense. And they might not even be sure why it makes sense. It seems to fit within the framework of the way they thought the world worked. But they're kind of drawn in, by kind of pulled in by a sense like, okay, there's something here I got to figure out. So again, you know, it's the challenge because we want to create a society of creative people, and we do that by being creative. You know, if you express it, then they'll resonate with it, and they'll resonate with what you want them to resonate with. You know, if you just give people the right the facts that they desire or the answers that they want, you know, frankly, they might even like you for doing that. But from your standpoint, they might be liking you for the wrong reasons, because they're not actually being really moved to understand on a deeper level what the human species actually is as a creator in the universe, as a creative factor of change in the universe. That to get people to resonate with that, you have to express that in the way you're organizing them. It has to be alive with you. And then it always, you know, the funny thing about the way communication really works, it becomes outside of the particulars. It becomes outside of the specifics of the discussion a lot of times, where it's not even so much in exactly what you said, but it's that you have that conception is alive in you, and they resonate with that, and that's what moves people. So I put it like that.
Hi. I was thinking about because when you say universe, I mean, of course, because I think most people, they have two questions. They usually have a concept of, well, you have like this kind of either big box or whatever, somebody more, a little more, has an idea that, and like what you call a manifold concept, but that when you say universe, you actually encompassing, in a certain sense, all what you'll call time, in a certain sense, also. So, like, I'll think about this potential realization is what's how what you can say is the what we let's say experience. That was the one thing, and then the other was like this terraforming Mars. Do you have any hypothesis? You have been a little bit into some of that question, but like, because we can't wait like 50 billion years or something like that to let life, you know, get its way up in, on Mars. So we have to like have some kind of an idea, that a hypothesis, how do we actually make something which will develop where we can realize the potential in a quick manner, let's say, like that. And then, I mean, because you also have this idea about this the domes where you have a controlled environment. I don't know if you can elaborate a little bit on these questions.
Yeah.
And sorry, and then, okay, I have a third thing also, just short, very short one. Because here in Denmark and in Europe, we don't usually have this idea of frontier. I mean, even the word frontier is like not very, I wonder, how is that in the American population, how is it like broadened in the, how is the idea of this frontier in the American population?
Yeah.
Oh, hi.
The last first, I would just say it's buried under a thick layer of demoralization.
Okay.
Especially times. I mean, and you do see it. I mean, just reflecting personally, you do see it in generations too. I mean, the World War II generation. People Lindsay's, people in their 70s, 80s, into their 90s now. It is clear there. You see it come out more clearly there. But I do think it's, I mean, it can be brought out with everybody. You know, the more people can see the change happening, they'll resonate with it. They get deep in there, so it's kind of, a lot of times you always got to fight with people to bring it out. I mean, what if people had the last, you know, decades to inspire them about any sense of a frontier, what mankind actually expresses? And they haven't had anything to resonate with, actually give them a real living sense of what that is. You know, you don't just get it just from reading a history book or something. So yeah, I think the Mars question, yeah, a lot of it's going to be experimental, and it's going to be the most thing. I mean, there's been a lot of work done. I'm not by no means up on all the literature that's been put out, and people have been studying this a lot. People get totally sick.
You're reporting that again, sorry.
You get people that are totally excited and fixated on the question of terraforming other planets, space exploration. There's a certain amount of wealth of literature on some aspects of these areas. Which I'm not fully up on, but I mean, definitely the quickest thing is going to be the experimental work, because we have to start, we just don't, there's certain bases we just don't know. And there's certain initial hypotheses that are pretty clear. I mean, we have a very clear program being discussed, like you have what Russia's committed to building with the city in Umka, this idea of designing a city way up around the Arctic Circle, one of the most northern islands in the Russian territory, building a fully domed, contained city, growing their own food there, trying to manage the biological cycles. So we have very clear ideas of first steps that can be brought to the moon, experimented with on the moon, and begun to see what results we get. And there's whole huge questions about how biology will act and acts in these new environments, and it's going to pose the certain things we don't even have the questions yet. It's part of it. We're going to, by actually going up and actually committing to the mission, is going to define certain specifics of the questions in terms of exactly how we're going to do it. But the basic structure, I think, is clear, and I think that that will pose the questions as we go. The first step will be the development of the moon and the development of the whole moon-Earth space, with multiple space stations, building trans atmospheric aircraft, building scramjet-type aircraft, craft that can actually get fuel from the atmosphere itself to get up into low Earth orbit. So instead of using huge rocket, all the fuel is contained in the rocket, most of the weight of the whole apparatus is even in the fuel, just to get up off the Earth. You know, there's better technology that exists that can move people and goods quickly and efficiently from the ground, from the ground level of the Earth up into low Earth orbit. From there, you can develop full, regular shuttle systems to get you to different space stations, get you to the moon. Now, a lot of this has been thought out by all the backs across Erica, others. And there's going to be certain questions that are going to be posed along the way. Taking the whole Earth-Moon system as a first step in building industrial facilities, building production facilities on the moon, just getting that accomplished, even if many of them are like automated, not even manned systems, even just getting us going is going to pose a lot of questions we're going to need to figure out in terms of the details. The question of actual terraforming of the whole planet, that is an open question. We're only going to really get at it with trying, with experimentation. I think that we have now, where we can just say we have, nobody's going to be sitting in their back room, wherever, somewhere on the globe, and say, this is how we're going to do it. Because we're a one planet species right now. We don't know about planet interactions. We don't know what's all involved in that, what's involved in the entirety of a biosphere for life. Again, Vernadsky defined and understood and discovered the biosphere as a single harmonic system that life is intimately connected with. The terraforming question is a fascinating question, but I think until we actually get to doing it, it's still going to remain a question. We can build certain bases to start with.
You're dropping out now.
One thing that some people are very much in favor of is instead of just the dome structures, actually build in depth under the surface, because the radiation that comes in is intense, for example, but also if you don't have the atmosphere, like on the moon or on Mars, you can get even smaller meteorites, different rocks, ones that burn up in our atmosphere, it wouldn't really be an issue. They can come in at extremely high velocities, and we have to make sure the dome structures are all strong enough and all that. But a lot of that's been, there's different options, a lot of them are probably feasible, but those are going to define the new questions as we go. And to the first question, it's a real challenge to work through the amount of brainwashing that comes from this reductionist education. And I can only say that Mr. LaRouche is brilliant in his scientific work, but then in his poetic ability to communicate it and to develop in your mind new conceptions that you've never thought of before, and actually get the significance of actually working his whole thesis on sense perception and putting an explicit focus on what is the actual effect of, what is the relationship to sense perception? What's sense perception's relationship to the universe? What ideas, including false ideas, do you get about the universe purely as a function of your biological sense perceptual apparatus? In a set of readings that you're experiencing the universe in a certain way, you're experiencing over time, you're experiencing it in something you could define as, against certain experiences, but then you have to, the human being can step back, the creative mind can step back and say, okay, well, this is what I'm experiencing. But how can I know if the descriptions I get based on these experiences actually fundamentally correspond to the way the universe actually is organized? And you see, discussed with the example of the time reversal, the feathers example, you get very clear descriptions that the universe is not organized the way your sense perception would have you immediately understand it. That it's not, you know, this idea of absolute space, absolute time, and cause just coming out of interactions among discrete objects floating in empty space and time. And this whole strict, sense perceptually defined notion of the universe fundamentally fails in any real scientific investigation. And you've had, it's only promoted because you've had the intentional promotion of it by the oligarchical system for the exact effects that it has, for the small-mindedness, the closing of the mind that it has, the lack of recognition of what the human species really is. So if you look at, you know, what does it say that the only way to really understand the history of life is that it expresses quality of creativity that we can best experience and reflecting on our own.
Can you repeat the last 3 seconds?
Yeah. What does it say that the only way we can really understand the history of life, evolutionary history of life, is that it is the fact that the qualities it expresses, the time reversal, the directionality, the harmonic organization of the whole thing, the movement towards higher states, what does it say that the only way we can really understand this, the only way it expresses itself in ways that we can understand, is best understood by the way we reflect on our own creative process. That the characteristics expressed distinctively by the history of life express a quality of mind, of creative action. And so the question becomes, disregarding all ordering of the universe, all ordering of what you thought about science, all ordering of cause, disregard all of that when it's based on any sense perceptual basis. And start from what can you really know? Because those are all functions of sense perception. Your conception of linear time is the only place that has any coherence, is coherence with the way you tend to experience things. Just by the fact of your biological apparatus. But then you take the work of Einstein, you don't have absolute time. It doesn't work. Science doesn't work with absolute time. It can't exist. You take the evolutionary history of life, you don't have absolute time. You have time acting backwards. You have future determining the past. You take human activities, exactly that. Human activity is mankind generating a conception, creative action in the mind. And then that determining a whole series of events after that, unfolding from that action, is that mankind is creating a future state before that future state even exists, and bringing that future state into existence. That when you begin to, you get rid of all the reductionist conceptions, and then study itself, what is the geometry of a creative process? What can we actually know about the characteristics of a creative process? And how is that expressed in the creation of the universe? And how can we then understand the universe from the top down as a process of creation, from the standpoint in which we can best understand creation, which isn't actually in the human mind, it's seeing it in ourselves expressing that. Because the human being the highest expression of that we know of, that we can actually get a sense of, that we can actually experience. And then how do you start from there, and then define the universe based on this conception? I mean, you see the absurdities going the other way are just endless. I mean, you take the very idea of a multiverse.
Of what? Can you repeat the last 3 seconds again?
Yeah. What the whole discussion of a multiverse, multiple universes. It doesn't make any sense. Universe, uni means one. So by saying universe, you're saying I'm discussing everything. And then how can you say, well, now we need multiple everythings to understand? There's no coherence. It doesn't make any sense.
Can you repeat the last 3 seconds?
It doesn't make any sense on the face of it. But these absurdities, because they're starting from sense perception. They're starting from notions of time and space and matter as being the fundamentals of the universe. And then they have evidence of things that actually happen. And they say, how do we explain these things that happen from the standpoint of what we claim are the elementary components, the basis, which is the absolute space, absolute time, matter, etc. And they just are led to these absurdities by saying, well, you know, what we're seeing, it must be our universe interacting with another universe, which, so the question is, how do you actually start from mind as being the substance, the cause? You know, and this is not new in a sense, because this is what Husa expressed in the most full expression at that time, and was the basis of the whole Renaissance. You know, that these are the periods when you've had huge leaps in mankind's economic progress, social conditions, cultural conditions. It's when you've had the recognition of this truthful understanding of human nature and the ordering of the universe. And human history has been defined by, it goes back to other thinkers too. I mean, the American Revolution, being birthed in the root in Cusa, had that element of that clearly in it as a conception governing the whole process. How are you actually recognizing the man as a creative force, not as an animal? Recognizing the top that man is a creative force, but a creative force that's coherent and resonant with the universe itself is a creative force. That mankind being a creative force means that creativity is a principle of the universe itself. That mankind is expressing a characteristic of the entire universe. That's the basis of our relationship and our existence. And so then how do you now build a political system that reflects that? How do you build a political system that actually coheres with that truthful understanding of the science of mankind's relationship to himself and to the universe around him? And that human progress has been defined by that struggle to realize that, to realize that culturally, to realize that politically. And it's been a direct struggle against this cultural legacy of this oligarchical system, which has to be understood, I think, as a cultural system. It's not just, some guy with his, evil scheme or something. It's an embedded cultural mentality that many of these oligarchs, are not even conscious or willful participants in. It's ingrained the way they think. They're programmed to think that way. That's their species characteristic. But that also affects the majority of people. The cultural effect of the majority of people being, of a type, as you see it in education, etc.
Sorry, in the type,
You see the effects. You see the effects of the oligarchical system on the oligarchical class, but then you also see the effects of the oligarchical system across humanity. Just the simplest small-mindedness you get from people. And this is what's the point? Why not even people that recognize that there's fundamental change that they could do that could happen, but then they just don't want to participate in it. It's just the legacy of this oligarchical class system. They're not logically coming to the conclusion that, because they might say it because of this and that. They might say it because this and that, I can't do anything. But their conception that they can't do anything came before their thinking because of this and that. So people are pre-programmed with this idea that, it's just the way things are, it's the way they're going to be. So it becomes a question of actually disregarding of all these legacies of this cultural legacy of this depraved system, and coming to the question of what is creativity as such? What is creativity in its most pure essence. And how is the organizing, how is the universe organized from the top down from that standpoint? And again, in the best expression of that, that we can understand and participate in, is ourselves. Like, we are the best expression of that that's accessible to us.
Thanks a lot. That was very moving. That's really great. So if there's no other questions, just wait a second. And just, if we would like to thank you a lot. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.